This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Religious scholars Carol and Philip Zaleski begin their book, Prayer, A History, with this thought. The story of prayer is the story of the impossible, of how we creatures of flesh and blood lay siege to heaven, speak to the maker of all things, and await with confidence or hopeful skepticism a response. Philip Zaleski and Carol Zaleski are our guests this afternoon. We'll talk with them about prayer and its practice around the world and across the ages. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. So if you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, feel free to call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. Philip Zaleski is a research associate in the Department of Religion at Smith College. He is the editor of the Best American Spiritual Writing Series and the author of The Recollected Heart and other works. Carol Zaleski is a professor of religion at Smith. She is the author of Otherworld Journeys and The Life of the World to Come. She's also a columnist for Christian Century. Our guests are co-editors of the Book of Heaven. Their book, Prayer, A History, is now available in paperback from Mariner Books, a division of Houghton Mifflin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Philip and Carol Zaleski, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be here, Celeste.
Yes, thanks for inviting us.
Yes, we have wanted to talk with you for a while now, and we finally are here today doing it. I took the first sentence from your book for my introduction, and I think it's a great starting point. What else would you like to say here at the beginning to describe what it is that people do in prayer?
Well, who would you like to hear from first?
Makes no difference. Just jump right in.
Oh, you
right
go
in.
Right ahead, dear.
Okay. We can't see each other, so we can't signal. But in any case, I guess we're often asked to define prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And many attempts have been made to define prayer. I think it boiled down for us to simply a form of communication. And we were very struck by how much prayer involves language and in many ways has guided the development of language in culture, language in other forms of expression. It seems that we have a fundamental need to communicate with not only the people that are right in front of us, but with the universe in some sense, so, with God, certainly if we believe in God. So that's our starting point, that is a language and a form of communication which is really essential to human life.
Yeah. Early in the book, and I'll direct this at Philip, you note that prayer has been compared to many things, including a storm and a nosegay. What are some of your favorite metaphors for the description of prayer?
Oh, well, I'm not sure I can pick out a specific metaphor, but I would say probably almost any metaphor you could come up with would fit prayer in some form or shape, because it's such a vast realm of human experience and human activity. It takes so many different forms: devotion, petition, thanksgiving, ecstasy, contemplation. It appears in the arts, and in painting, and literature. Scientists are interested in prayer. So, given this vast range of possibilities, I guess the first metaphor anyone thinks of could be plugged in and would fit quite well.
Yeah,
I think bearing in mind that prayer can be silent, even though we started off saying that prayer is a form of communication or speech, one of the myriad forms that it takes is silent contemplation. So there is a vast spectrum. And we were really concerned in this book to, well, we couldn't be comprehensive, but we did want to take into account this great variety and not treat certain forms of prayer as the top of the hierarchy and neglect others.
With contemplative prayer, which is a very interesting form of prayer, language is also involved, though, yes?
Yeah, very much so, and maybe it's an internalized language. It's a language of the heart, and also very often contemplative prayer is elicited by the use of simple expressions like the Sanskrit syllable om, which is a word, but also a sound and a vibration that instills a kind of serenity. So spoken language shades off into this sort of silent utterance of the heart.
In fact, I would follow up on that by saying one of the most interesting things in the experience of prayer, people's actual lived experience, is that prayer states sort of blend into one another. So the other day I was reading the autobiography of Teresa of Avila, who is a 16th century Spanish mystic and saint. She wrote several books about prayer, and she described how she would be reciting the Lord's Prayer or a Hail Mary and suddenly be thrown into a state of ecstasy. And then when she would come down from the state of ecstasy, she might find herself in a contemplative state. So prayer can be seen as a spectrum. Well, there's a metaphor. Prayer is a spectrum, and you might start at any point on the spectrum and end up at any other point on the spectrum.
Hmm. Is it possible to say when and where and by whom the first prayers were said?
Well, we conjecture in our book that Neanderthal man or Neanderthals prayed. This is based on circumstantial evidence, because there's certainly evidence for ritual burials, and we argue in the book that wherever one finds religious ritual, one finds prayer, that the two are really never separated. And so we would think that as soon as human beings attained self-consciousness, which inevitably leads to questioning one's place in the cosmos, prayer is an inevitable result of that.
Mm. And with prayer, the act of praying itself, did people begin to think about what they were doing and what it meant?
Yeah, it could be that beliefs about God or angels, spirits, and all of that are secondary in a sense. That is, they come about through reflection on this primary experience of questioning the cosmos and throwing a line out towards it, you know, asking for a response. And then you begin to reflect, well, I seem to be able to have this personal communication with the forces of nature, with the clouds, with the stars. What does that mean? Are there persons out there, personalities? I wouldn't want to try to twist that into a theory of the origin of religion, but I think it's hard to know what comes first in this sort of question, and we wanted to emphasize how primordial prayer is. Yeah. You really can't get to the bottom of it or to the beginning of it.
Nor can you find a society nowadays that doesn't have prayer as a major component. Even in cultures that work very hard to suppress religion and suppress all spiritual life, you might think of Stalinist Russia, Nazi Germany, there were certainly vast currents of prayer going on under the surface. So prayer does seem to be universal in that sense.
Yeah, or different. I'm thinking now of in Ireland, when Catholicism was put down, it just simply went underground, and it could be even expressed openly, but it was in code.
This says something about our secular society today. In many ways, we do live in a secular society. And I suppose an anthropologist from Mars coming to visit would understand the intensity of secular feeling and secular legal structures that we have at the same time. On the one hand, there's a great deal of interest in organized religion. Most Americans participate in some form or other of organized religion, which involves prayer, and even those that don't, I think most, I'd hesitate to say all, but most might pray at some time or other in their life.
Yeah, there's some wonderful, delightful ambiguities and paradoxes in all this. For instance, the document that has played a big part in the Supreme Court decision to ban prayer in public schools is James Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, composed in 1784. And Madison very strongly asks for a separation, you might say, Jefferson would call the wall of separation between religion and civil society. But the memorial ends with a prayer. So the very text, which is setting up a wall against the prayer in the public square, is actually knit together by a prayer to the supreme lawgiver of the universe.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You also have within the book Prayer History, you know, a chapter on prayer in the public square and what happens when there is, and this is the way you put it, and it's marvelous, a collision of prayers. What are your observations, thoughts on navigating this stormy sea?
I'd say you need a very good compass to start out with.
Yeah.
I mean, the possibility of shipwreck is very strong considering... Yeah. Just what's happened in recent months. Behind the Pope's comments about Islam were a great deal of reflection within the Vatican in recent years about how to pray with other faiths or how to pray alongside other faiths. And in fact, with versus alongside is one of the important issues that is it's tricky. It's tricky because every religion has its own prayers, and the prayers, even if they seem to go to the same divine being, often are actually aimed differently in some way or another. And people's sensitivities are so raw that really a great deal of thought is required. It's not just a simple matter of everybody joining hands and praying together happily.
Yeah, you in fact offer a note of caution about interfaith prayer.
I think the problem is where does prayer end and where does worship begin?
Mm.
And if you're praying with someone else, are you in some way being unfaithful to your own beliefs in order to accommodate those of another? And perhaps you're forcing someone else to be unfaithful to their beliefs to accommodate yours. On the other hand, we don't want people locked 24 hours a day in their own cells praying privately without any exchange of ideas. So a compromise has to be found, a common ground where you can pray sincerely and authentically within your own faith and yet open yourself to the prayer experience of other people.
Well, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests today, Philip Zaleski and Carol Zaleski. They are the authors of Prayer, A History. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener on line 4 in Eureka. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much. A timely subject. Congratulations on meeting your fundraising goal.
Oh, thank you.
Two questions, if possible, please.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm thinking about different controversies about specific answers to prayer, and I know this probably comes from more the conservative end of the theological spectrum, but my mind goes to George Mueller, who I believe ran a series of orphanages in England, who did not do much fundraising, but supposedly had a very long list of answered prayers. Do you deal with the subject of specific answers to prayers in your book? And how do you feel about it?
Well, we do say that we consider petitionary prayer to be prayer par excellence, which means that's a kind of prayer which is asking for something. There have been some writers about prayer who have looked down upon that, who said that it's not as spiritually exalted to be asking God for things, that God should already know what you need, and that it's self-centered to ask for things. And we don't agree with that. We consider petitionary prayer to be central in all religious traditions and even to be mandated for Christians who are concerned with this question. They have the example of Jesus performing a petitionary prayer and teaching his disciples to use petitionary prayer. Mm-hmm. Now, then that opens the question, how do you know when a prayer is answered, and what do you do with prayers that don't seem to be answered? I wouldn't say we have a pat answer to that question. It's one of the great mysteries of prayer.
Did you deal with persons who, like, would keep a journal or a diary of specific answers to prayer and possibly examine them?
I think my husband should handle that one, because we dealt with Samuel Johnson's massive diary of prayer, and he knows it better than I do.
Well, Samuel Johnson, the great English writer and journalist and essayist, 17th century, I believe it was 17th century, or was it 18th century? I'm not sure. Anyway, this wonderful, great figure, much beloved in England and not well-known enough in America, kept a prayer journal over the course of 60 or 70 years. And poor Samuel kept praying for things that never came. He kept praying for temperance in drink, temperance in language, temperance in sexual activity. And he would make these prayers on his birthday every year, and at Easter every year, and at Christmas every year. And the following year, he would bemoan the fact that he was sunk in the mire of sin again. And this would go on and on and on and on. It went on for his whole life. However, he developed a very close relationship with God through this continual yearning and through the process of falling back and trying again. And I think the trying itself became for him an important expression of his ultimate wish to be with God and to live faithfully. So in itself, although he failed, he succeeded. And I think we find this in a lot of people. A lot of people understand that their specific prayers aren't answered, mm-hmm. but they learn something through the failure to get an answer. Now, on the other hand, you have people who claim that they have special techniques that will allow prayers to be answered. Mm-hmm. You know, if you pray in a certain way, or if you pray through my faculties, you will get a bright yellow Cadillac at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know how to respond to that, except I can say that we did a thorough analysis of scientific studies of answered prayers, and we found that all the scientific studies, without exception, had flaws in them, which isn't to say that we don't believe the prayers are answered. I think my wife and I both believe very strongly that they are. But we don't think that that's been established in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm. I recognize probably it depends upon your biblical interpretation approach. Second question is, have you ever heard of I believe he's a French sociologist, Jacques Ellul, in his book Prayer and Modern Man, and he has a concept of kind of prayer as a heavenly telephone. It's kind of interesting. Mm. More or less like God is a Santa Claus, a giver of many divine things. I mean, he's really critiquing a lot of the, nonsense of Christendom, but do you have an opinion on his book?
Well, maybe Santa Claus is a hint about God,
yeah.
Rather than God being, rather than our worrying too much about God being reduced to Santa Claus. There are, you know, cases, as Philip just pointed out, where people have a naively instrumental sort of view of how they're going to use a prayer technique and get something for it. But we also, in surveying the history of prayer, looking at prayer in different cultures, we saw how very often it is very closely akin to magic, and there isn't always a sharp division between magic and prayer. But if there is a distinction to be made, it's somewhere along the lines that magic tends to want to coerce God, to force God's hand, and prayer involves more of a trusting relationship, which asks for things and then values that relationship even more than the things that are being asked for.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And maybe here it would be good to talk about the Papago, praying for good weather, which in the case that we're talking about good weather here is rain.
Right.
Wonderful petitionary prayer.
It is a wonderful petitionary prayer. And the curious thing is it's always answered, in fact. I was going to say almost, but it's always answered because the Papago know the weather cycles in their part of the world and match the prayers to the weather cycles, which isn't to say that there isn't an authentic supernatural exchange going on. It's simply to say that the supernatural exchange and the natural understanding of weather go hand in hand in the minds of the Papago, and that's about all one can say about it.
Mm. That's actually quite encouraging, because what it means is that when they pray for rain and then it rains, they're able to receive that rain as a gift from God, which is a very wonderful way to live, to be able to feel that you are receiving gifts, every day.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that I was thinking about is going along through your book, Prayer History, is that prayer includes by its very nature awe.
Yeah.
And thanksgiving and a desire for transformation.
Right, right. Yeah, it does. It really cultivates virtues and dispositions, states of mind that are wonderful in themselves. Again, abstaining from the question of whether the prayer request is fulfilled, the way in which it transforms the person who prays, as Kierkegaard says, he says that the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard says, prayer doesn't change God, it changes the person who prays.
The tale of spiritual transformation or inner transformation that struck me most as I was researching the book was Bill W.'s story in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous and the story of many alcoholics who came after him or who worked alongside him. Bill himself discovered prayer, discovered an inner life while in the depths of despair over his inability to control alcohol. And it was actually through prayer, it was through a mystical experience which was surrounded by prayer, that he attained sobriety. And he always emphasized the absolutely vital aspect of prayer in one's search for sobriety. It's encoded in the 12 steps. And outside of the 12 steps, he wrote about prayer quite a lot. And in fact, I believe in early AA meetings, and in many AA meetings to this day, the Lord's Prayer is an essential part of the meeting.
And the Serenity Prayer, which has been made famous by AA, though it wasn't composed by members of AA. So, yes, in fact, it's interesting in Bill W.'s case. He had an ecstatic experience after which he was able to maintain sobriety. But as the movement, this recovery movement, developed, they realized that you can't manufacture ecstatic experiences in people to cure them of their addictions. But what you can do is pray daily and habitually, just simply practice prayer. You don't have to have exalted mystical consciousness in order to have a process of transformation take place. But prayer and fellowship are really the two interrelated pillars. That's not a mixed metaphor. It is a mixed metaphor. But anyway, those are even more essential than what Bill W. would later call his hot flash experience when he saw God and was was lit up from within.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Gibson City on line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. I guess I'm talking about prayer, and when I was young in my faith, an older woman had commented about she was glad in certain situations when she couldn't pray that people were praying for her. And I didn't quite understand it until I got older and had situations where I just couldn't pray anymore. But it was such a blessing to know that people were praying for me and my family. And I just wonder if you, have any comments on that. And I'll hang up and listen.
I'm very glad you mentioned that, because I think that's another key thing, which was actually what I had in mind when I mentioned the ingredient of fellowship in the spiritual recovery movement. And that is that prayer is not really a solitary, lonely thing. It really is a communal aspect to it. And you see this most strongly in intercessory prayer, prayers that are asking for things, not for oneself, but for others. There's a sense in which that unites people, and that's one of the great fruits of prayer, to know that you're being prayed for. While this may not be validated by any scientific studies, it's validated in experience as a great gift.
I'd also say that on a very mundane level, the fact is that people's experience of prayer is of group prayer as much as it is of private prayer. People pray, sure, when they go to sleep at night, they might pray by themselves, but people also say grace with the family before a meal, and people go to church or synagogue or a mosque and pray with crowds of people. And this is a vital part of their prayer experience. So prayer is very much a communal activity.
It also unites the living and the dead. One of the most common forms of prayer throughout the world is prayer for the dead, whether, in the Catholic tradition, praying for souls in purgatory. There's something very similar in China and in East Asian Buddhist cultures, which have a very strong sense of obligation to pray and to perform rituals and give offerings for the sake of the dead. And that creates tremendous social coherence, a sense that when members of one's family pass on, they're not lost. There's a bond created by the obligation to pray for them. And then on the other end, there's a sense that the saints can pray for us.
What is the relationship between faith, prayer, and religion? How do they fit together?
You want to take that one, Carol?
Sure. Well, I think of faith as trust. So faith is a disposition, trusting, taking things on faith. So that's a very important aspect of all belief systems. There's also faith in the sense of belief, that is, holding certain beliefs as true. Prayer is an activity that's conducive to faith in both those senses, and that, in fact, even if you don't have faith, I don't think you have faith, if you pray, sometimes the faith follows. That's what the genius Pascal said. Just pray, and a sense of faith will arise in you. It's a kind of experiment in faith that prayer makes possible. But prayer is also an expression of faith. So that's how I see them related. Religion is a big and sometimes a bit problematic word that we use in the West to describe, in many ways, the most essential activities of the human race.
Prayer, as we've kind of talked about a little bit, can take many forms. You think of a prayer like the Our Father, which one of you has mentioned. Then I think of a prayer that a character in the character Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. He's a man always, it seems like to me, he's always in prayer. It's been a long time since I've seen that show, but, uh-huh. He is a man of faith, but he is questioning his God.
Right, that's a venerable Jewish tradition of prayer where you question, you argue with God. That shows how closely you are connected to God when you can do that.
Yeah. Is that kind of prayer found in other traditions?
I think Jewish tradition has developed that to the highest degree. But I don't think there's any aspect of prayer, of that spectrum of prayer, that isn't represented to one degree or another in every fully realized, fully developed religious tradition. That's one of the amazing things that you find when you study religion, that each religion is a kind of a complete cosmos, a complete way of life and culture, and that cultures that have suppressed their religious heritage are often really hobbled by that.
Hmm. Would it be accurate to say there is a human instinct for prayer, that we need it?
Well, I would say it's accurate. On the one hand, we weren't able to find any culture that doesn't pray.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I believe there is one obscure, small group somewhere, I forget where it is, maybe somewhere in South Asia, studied by anthropologists, that didn't seem to have prayer, but they had determined that these people had gone through a terrible period of suffering and loss, and they were in an aberrant state, and that seemed to correspond to the lack of prayer. Otherwise, prayer does seem to be universal. And then we ask ourselves why it's universal. Well, people in the past have conjectured that perhaps God instilled it in us as a means to find him. Other people would say that it's, they might give a Freudian explanation or a Marxist explanation. But whatever the explanation is, it does seem that prayer is absolutely fundamental to human behavior.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Philip and Carol Zaleski are our guests this afternoon. They are the authors of Prayer, a History. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about the role of prayer or its connection to human creativity. This is something that you write about in the book, music, poetry, the visual arts. Talk with us about that. Maybe take an artist, and there are so many to choose from, and you mentioned so many in this portion of the book. I thought your discussion of Vermeer was very interesting. Maybe that would be a good place to start.
Right. Well, the first thing we discovered was that the role of prayer in the arts really hasn't been studied much. I imagine it's because people that study aesthetics and people that study religion live in different spheres. But whatever the reason, we found that in painting and in poetry and in music, prayer played a very large part. Even when there was no explicit religiosity in the work, and Vermeer is a fine example of that. Vermeer himself was a religious man, a Christian. However, his paintings attempted to capture a world imbued with the presence of God, or imbued with a light and an atmosphere in which one sensed something divine. And he would do this by taking very simple, ordinary moments in life, a woman measuring her jewels, or a woman pouring milk out of a jug. And in the composition and the quality of the light and the expressions on the faces of his figures, you feel pressing in on the painting, or perhaps we can say coming out of the painting, a very strong sense of the divine, of God's presence. And Vermeer accomplished this, I think, to a degree that no other artist really has achieved, although we talk about some photographers that managed to come very similar in their photographs to a very similar place. And you find similar attempts in all the arts.
Right. We talk about Gerard Manley Hopkins, whose prayer, whose poetic language was really a prayer language. And also the connections between prayer and the performing arts, the dramatic arts, and dance and so on, are very intimate, because prayer is so often, if not always, connected in some way to ritual. The origins of theater really are in ritual, and prayer is frames our experience for us by giving us these ritual moments in which something like what Vermeer was trying to achieve becomes available to a religious community. So when people are at prayer in community and there are solemn gestures involved and beauty is involved and special kinds of speaking, of singing, of movement, all of that is right at the very heart and origin of the dramatic arts. And I think very often the dramatic arts in a secular society are an effort in some way to get back to that original unity of art and prayer.
Mm. And that brings us back to magic, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. Yeah. Because magical prayer, there are great collections of magical prayer and actually in the Roman Empire and early Christian tradition, there are these amazing magical prayers. And in Jewish tradition, there are magical prayers. Maybe you wouldn't find them being used in the synagogue today, but they're there in the tradition. But they have this quality of using language poetically and using archaic language, using language in a mysterious sort of way that I think prayer often does. Even when it's not conscious of having any sort of magical interest.
Yeah.
And you know, we see this too in many modern poets, T.S. Eliot and Carol mentioned Gerard Manley Hopkins, both poets who attempted to, in the very music of the language, to produce something that was prayerful, not only in the content of what they're saying, but in the way one syllable jostles, rubs against another, and the way this rubbing produces a friction, which becomes a sort of spiritual heat and spiritual light. You find a wedding there of ancient ideas about magic and postmodern poetic technique. There's a bit of this in Yeats, too.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
Hello. Maybe you've addressed this, but one of the puzzling things about people who a religious bent, particularly Christians, they will say the Lord's Prayer in public and together. And, of course, that comes right out of the passage in the Bible where Jesus says, don't do this. You know,
yeah.
Go into your own room, pray to God in private. And yet that prayer is, it really is not a prayer. It's a lesson on what a prayer should be like. Could you address that problem for me? That's always puzzled me.
Yeah, it's kind of a charming inconsistency in the tradition, isn't it? I don't know how to answer that. I think it's there are different treatments of this episode in the Bible where Jesus is responding to the disciples saying, Lord, teach us to pray. So it's kind of, this is a prayer lesson, as you're saying. when he says pray in private, the way I take it to mean is that, you know, don't be ostentatious about your praying. Don't pray, but like you're saying, don't give alms so that other people can see you and think you're terribly
But the other part of that is that the only other time, if you go through the Bible and look at the times that Jesus prayed, there is the incident of the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yeah.
And what did he do? He went a stone throw away.
Right.
To separate himself
right.
from the public.
That's right. That is important, yes. Of course, he also wanted his disciples to be there, that stone throw away, and he would have preferred that they stay awake and, you know, be watchful with him. So it's not total separation, but there is a sense, and there's also an important Christian tradition of the prayer of the hermit, of holy men and women who retire into the desert to be alone with God.
Yeah.
That's what monasticism is about. Uh-huh. Monk means solitary. So there's a tension in the Christian tradition between that impulse to have a solitary communion with God, where you know the noise and commotion of the world.
And doesn't that point to the fact that maybe the tradition wants us to, when we communicate with God, we do so in private so we can be closer to him because of that.
Yeah, I think that's certainly being recommended to us, maybe not in isolation, you know, not as the only thing one does, because mm-hmm. there's always the need to return to.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. At the same time, this is a prayer that is often recited within places of worship, which you could say is in a sense a collective but private space.
Yeah,
and I think it's important to remember, if we're talking about Jesus, that he himself was active in the synagogue and certainly prayed with his apostles and disciples. So it's not that he always went off by himself to pray. I think there were a variety of prayer forms, and each has its place. And I would agree with Carol that the instruction to retreat into a cell to pray was meant in that particular context as an admonition not to be ostentatious in your prayer, not to be proud of your prayer, not to let other people know how holy you are.
Mm. Within a monastery, you have both forms of
right.
prayer, though.
That's right. As monasticism developed, it actually moved away from this idea of the solitary hermit to a more communal form in which you have the Lord's Prayer and the other prayers of the Christian tradition of the liturgy done communally. But there's also time for private prayer and meditation, and they're seen as working together, and that oscillation between the solitary and the communal is very important. I think also when you pray alone, you're not really alone. You really are praying, as that caller suggested, when you're praying for other people, you're praying in union with the living and the dead. The saints and angels maybe are part of that prayer, and you're connected to the other members of your faith community, whether they're physically next to you or not, and you're using a shared language. You're not making it up as you go along. You're not in a solipsistic kind of world of your own.
Mm. Last question, we got to wrap up. What do you hope folks take from this book, Prairie History, believers and non-believers?
Well, I'd say in understanding that prayer is not one thing, the prayer is a vast universe with a multiplicity of forms and colors and sounds, that prayer is tremendously exciting, and actually, and I know this will shock most of your listeners, prayer is a lot of fun.
Carol?
Okay, I'll go with that. And, okay. You know, and also to say that there isn't just one little compartment of life called prayer, that prayer really enters into many different departments of life, even in our so-called secular society, that if once you start to notice it, you'll see it everywhere.
Yeah, start to tease it out. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us this
afternoon.
Thank you.
Philip and Carol Zaleski, they are the authors of Prayer, A History, the book now available in paperback from Mariner Books, a division of Houghton Mifflin.